Colonel Cathcart asserted petulantly from a far corner of the office, paying no attention to Colonel Korn.
"Very critical times, indeed," Colonel Korn agreed with a placid nod. "We've just had a change of command above, and we can't afford a situation that might put us in a bad light with either General Shyskoff or General Peckham. Isn't that what you mean, Colonel?"
"Hasn't he got any patriotism?"
"Won't you fight for your country?"
Colonel Korn demanded, emulating Colonel Cathcart's harsh, self-righteous tone.
"Won't you give up your life for Colonel Cathcart and me?"
The Osarian tensed with alert astonishment when he heard Colonel Korn's concluding words.
"What's that?" he exclaimed. "What have you and Colonel Cathcart got to do with my country? You're not the same."
"How can you separate us?"
Colonel Korn inquired with ironical tranquility.
"That's right," Colonel Cathcart cried emphatically. "You're either for us or against us. There's no two ways about it."
"I'm afraid he's got you," added Colonel Korn. "You're either for us or against your country. It's as simple as that."
"Oh, no, Colonel. I don't buy that."
Colonel Korn was unruffled.
"Neither do I, frankly, but everyone else will, so there you are."
"You're a disgrace to your uniform," Colonel Cathcart declared with blustering wrath, whirling to confront Yossarian for the first time. "I'd like to know how you ever got to be a captain, anyway."
"You promoted him," Colonel Korn reminded him sweetly, stifling a snicker. "Don't you remember?"
"Well, I should never have done it."
"I told you not to do it," Colonel Korn said, "but you just wouldn't listen to me."
"Gee whiz, will you stop rubbing it in?" Colonel Cathcart cried.
He furrowed his brow and glowered at Colonel Korn through eyes narrow with suspicion, his fists clenched on his hips.
"Say, whose side are you on, anyway?"
"Your side, Colonel. What other side could I be on?"
"Then stop picking on me, will you? Get off my back, will you?"
"I'm on your side, Colonel. I'm just loaded with patriotism."
"Well, just make sure you don't forget that."
Colonel Cathcart turned away grudgingly after another moment, incompletely reassured, and began striding the floor again, his hands kneading his long cigarette holder. He jerked a thumb toward Yossarian.
"Let's settle with him. I know what I'd like to do with him. I'd like to take him outside and shoot him. That's what I'd like to do with him. That's what General Dreidel would do with him."
"But General Dreidel isn't with us anymore," said Colonel Korn. "So we can't take him outside and shoot him."
Now that his moment of tension with Colonel Cathcart had passed, Colonel Korn relaxed again and resumed kicking softly against Colonel Cathcart's desk. He returned to Yossarian.
"So, we're going to send you home instead. It took a bit of thinking, but we finally worked out this horrible little plan for sending you home without causing too much dissatisfaction among the friends you'll leave behind. Doesn't that make you happy?"
"What kind of plan? I'm not sure I'm going to like it."
"I know you're not going to like it," Colonel Korn laughed, locking his hands contentedly on top of his head again. "You're going to loathe it. It really is odious, and it will certainly offend your conscience. But you'll agree to it quickly enough. You'll agree to it because it will send you home safe and sound in 2 weeks, and because you have no choice. It's that or a court-martial. Take it or leave it."
Yossarian snorted.
"Stop bluffing, Colonel. You can't court-martial me for desertion in the face of the enemy. It would make you look bad, and you probably couldn't get a conviction."
"But we can court-martial you now for desertion from duty, since you went to Rome without a pass. And we could make it stick. If you think about it a minute, you'll see that you'd leave us no alternative. We can't simply let you keep walking around in open insubordination without punishing you. All the other men would stop flying missions, too. No, you have my word for it. We will court-martial you if you turn our deal down, even though it would raise a lot of questions and be a terrible black eye for Colonel Cathcart."
Colonel Cathcart winced at the words "black eye," and without any apparent premeditation, hurled his slender onyx and ivory cigarette holder down viciously on the wooden surface on his desk.
"Jesus Christ!" he shouted unexpectedly. "I hate this goddamn cigarette holder."
The cigarette holder bounced off the desk to the wall, ricocheted across the windowsill to the floor, and came to a stop almost where he was standing. Colonel Cathcart stared down at it with an irascible scowl.
One of us really doing me any good.
It's a feather in your cap with General Peckham, but a black eye for you with General Shyskoff,
Colonel Korn informed him with a mischievous look of innocence.
But which one am I supposed to please?
Both.
How can I please them both? They hate each other. How am I ever going to get a feather in my cap from General Shyskoff without getting a black eye from General Peckham?
March.
Yeah, march. That's the only way to please him. March. March!
Colonel Cathcart grimaced sullenly.
Some generals, they're a disgrace to their uniforms. If people like those two can make general, I don't see how I can miss.
You're going to go far,
Colonel Korn assured him with a flat lack of conviction, and turned back chuckling to Yossarian, his disdainful merriment increasing at the sight of Yossarian's unyielding expression of antagonism and distrust.
And there you have the crux of the situation. Colonel Cathcart wants to be a general, and I want to be a colonel. And that's why we have to send you home.
Why does he want to be a general?
Why? For the same reason that I want to be a colonel. What else have we got to do? Everyone teaches us to aspire to higher things. A general is higher than a colonel, and a colonel is higher than a lieutenant colonel. So we're both aspiring. And you know, Yossarian, it's a lucky thing for you that we are. Your timing on this is absolutely perfect. But I suppose you took that factor into account in your calculations.
I haven't been doing any calculating, Yossarian retorted.
Yes, I really do enjoy the way you lie, Colonel Korn answered. Won't it make you proud to have your commanding officer promoted to general? To know you served in an outfit that averaged more combat missions per person than any other? Don't you want to earn more unit citations and more oak leaf clusters for your air medal? Where's your esprit de corps? Don't you want to contribute further to this great record by flying more combat missions? It's your last chance to answer yes.
No.
In that case, you have us over a barrel, said Colonel Korn without rancor.
He ought to be ashamed of himself.
And we have to send you home. Just do a few little things for us, and—
What sort of things?
Yossarian interrupted with belligerent misgiving.
Oh, tiny, insignificant things. Really, this is a very generous deal we're making with you. We will issue orders returning you to the States. Really, we will. And all you have to do in return is—
What? What must I do?
Colonel Korn laughed curtly.
Like us.
Yossarian blinked.
Like you?
Like us.
Like you?
That's right,
said Colonel Korn, nodding, gratified immeasurably by Yossarian's guileless surprise and bewilderment.
Like us. Join us. Be our pal. Say nice things about us here and back in the States. Become one of the boys. Now, that isn't asking too much, is it?
You just want me to like you. Is that all?
That's all.
That's all?
Just find it in your heart to like us.
Yossarian wanted to laugh confidently when he saw with amazement that Colonel Korn was telling the truth.
That isn't going to be too easy, he sneered.
Oh, it will be a lot easier than you think,
Colonel Korn taunted in return, undismayed by Yossarian's barb. You'll be surprised at how easy you'll find it to like us once you begin. Colonel Korn hitched up the waist of his loose, voluminous trousers. The deep, black grooves isolating his square chin from his jowls were bent again in a kind of jeering and reprehensible mirth.
You see, Yossarian, we're going to put you on Easy Street. We're going to promote you to major and even give you another medal. Captain Flume is already working on glowing press releases describing your valor over Ferrara, your deep and abiding loyalty to your outfit, and your consummate dedication to duty. Those phrases are all actual quotations, by the way. We're going to glorify you and send you home a hero, recalled by the Pentagon for morale and public relations purposes. You'll live like a millionaire. Everyone will lionize you. You'll have parades in your honor and make speeches to raise money for war bonds. A whole new world of luxury awaits you once you become our pal. Isn't it lovely?
Yossarian found himself listening intently to the fascinating elucidation of details.
I'm not sure I want to make speeches.
Then we'll forget the speeches. The important thing is what you say to people here.
Colonel Korn leaned forward earnestly, no longer smiling.
We don't want any of the men in the group to know that we're sending you home as a result of your refusal to fly more missions. And we don't want General Peckham or General Shyskov to get wind of any friction between us either. That's why we're going to become such good pals.
What will I say to the men who ask me why I refuse to fly more missions?
Tell them you had been informed in confidence that you were being returned to the States and that you were unwilling to risk your life for another mission or two. Just a minor disagreement between pals. That's all.
Will they believe it?
Of course they'll believe it, once they see what great friends we've become, and when they see the press releases and read the flattering things you have to say about me and Colonel Cathcart. Don't worry about the men. They'll be easy enough to discipline and control when you've gone. It's only while you're still here that they may prove troublesome. You know, one good apple can spoil the rest,
Colonel Korn concluded with conscious irony.
You know, this really would be wonderful. You might even serve as an inspiration to them to fly more missions.
Suppose I denounce you when I get back to the States.
After you've accepted our medal and promotion and all the fanfare? No one would believe you. The Army wouldn't let you. And why in the world should you want to? You're going to be one of the boys, remember? You'll enjoy a rich, rewarding, luxurious, privileged existence. You'd have to be a fool to throw it all away for just a moral principle. And you're not a fool. Is it a deal?
I don't know.
It's that or a court-martial.
That's a pretty scummy trick I'd be playing on the men in the squadron, isn't it?
Odious,
Colonel Korn agreed amiably, and waited, watching Yossarian patiently with a glimmer of private delight.
Well, what the hell? Yossarian exclaimed. If they don't want to fly more missions, let them stand up and do something about it the way I did, right?
Of course, said Colonel Korn.
There's no reason I have to risk my life for them, is there?
Of course not.
Yossarian arrived at his decision with a swift grin.
It's a deal, he announced jubilantly.
Great,
said Colonel Korn with somewhat less cordiality than Yossarian had expected, and he slid himself off Colonel Cathcart's desk to stand on the floor. He tugged the folds of cloth of his pants and undershorts free from his crotch and gave Yossarian a limp hand to shake.
Welcome aboard.
Thanks, Colonel.
Call me Blackie, John. We're pals now.
Sure, Blackie. My friends call me Yo-Yo. Blackie,
His friends call him Yo-Yo, Colonel Korn sang out to Colonel Cathcart. Why don't you congratulate Yo-Yo on what a sensible move he's making?
That's a real sensible move you're making, Yo-Yo,
Colonel Cathcart said, pumping Yossarian's hand with clumsy zeal.
Thank you, Colonel.
Call him Chuck, said Colonel Korn.
Sure, call me Chuck, said Colonel Cathcart with a laugh that was hearty and awkward. We're all pals now. Sure, Chuck.
Exit smiling,
said Colonel Korn, his hands on both their shoulders as the three of them moved to the door.
Come on over for dinner with us some night, Yo-Yo,
Colonel Cathcart invited hospitably.
How about tonight, in the group dining room? I'd love to, sir.
Chuck,
Colonel Korn corrected reprovingly.
I'm sorry, Blackie. Chuck. I can't get used to it.
That's all right, pal.
Sure, pal.
Thanks, pal.
Don't mention it, pal.
So long, pal.
Yossarian waved goodbye fondly to his new pals and sauntered out onto the balcony corridor, almost bursting into song the instant he was alone.
He was home free. He had pulled it off. His act of rebellion had succeeded. He was safe, and he had nothing to be ashamed of to anyone.
He started toward the staircase with a jaunty and exhilarated air. A private in green fatigues saluted him. Yossarian returned the salute happily, staring at the private with curiosity. It looked strangely familiar. When Yossarian returned the salute, the private in green fatigues turned suddenly into Natalie's whore and lunged at him murderously with a bone-handled kitchen knife that caught him in the side below his upraised arm. Yossarian sank to the floor with a shriek, shutting his eyes in overwhelming terror as he saw the girl lift the knife to strike him again. He was already unconscious when Colonel Korn and Colonel Cathcart dashed out of the office and saved his life by frightening her away. 41. Snowden.
"Cut," said a doctor. "You cut," said another.
"No cuts," said Yossarian with a thick, unwieldy tongue.
"Now look who's butting in," complained one of the doctors.
"Another county heard from. Are we going to operate or aren't we?"
"He doesn't need an operation," complained the other.
"It's a small wound. All we have to do is stop the bleeding, clean it out, and put a few stitches in."
"But I've never had a chance to operate before." "Which one's a scalpel? Is this one a scalpel?"
"No, the other one's a scalpel."
"Well, go ahead and cut already if you're going to. Make the incision."
"Like this?"
"Not there, you dope."
"No incisions,"
Yossarian said, perceiving through the lifting fog of insensibility that two strangers were ready to begin cutting him.
"Another county heard from," complained the first doctor sarcastically.
"Is he going to keep talking that way while I operate on him?"
"You can't operate on him until I admit him," said a clerk.
"You can't admit him until I clear him," said a fat, gruff colonel with a mustache and enormous pink face that pressed down very close to Yossarian and radiated scorching heat like the bottom of a huge frying pan.
"Where are you born?"
The fat, gruff colonel reminded Yossarian of the fat, gruff colonel who had interrogated the chaplain and found him guilty. Yossarian stared up at him through a glassy film. The cloying sense of formaldehyde and alcohol sweetened the air.
"On a battlefield," he answered.
No. In what state were you born?"
"In a state of innocence."
No. You don't understand."
"Let me handle him,"
urged a hatchet-faced man with sunken, acrimonious eyes and a thin, malevolent mouth.
"Are you a smart aleck or something?"
he asked Yossarian.
"He's delirious,"
one of the doctors said.
"Why don't you let us take him back inside and treat him?"
"Leave him right here if he's delirious. He might say something incriminating."
"But he's still bleeding profusely, can't you see? He might even die."
"Good for him." "It would serve the pinky bastard right," said the fat, gruff colonel. "All right, John, let's speak out. We want to get to the truth."
"Everyone calls me Yo-Yo."
"We want you to cooperate with us, Yo-Yo. We're your friends, and we want you to trust us. We're here to help you. We're not going to hurt you."
"Let's jab our thumbs down inside the wound and gouge it," suggested the hatchet-faced man.
Yossarian let his eyes fall closed and hoped they would think he was unconscious.
"He's fainted,"
he heard a doctor say.
"Can we treat him now before it's too late? He really might die."
"All right, take him. I hope the bastard does die."
"You can't treat him until I admit him," the clerk said.
Yossarian played dead with his eyes shut while the clerk admitted him by shuffling some papers, and then he was rolled away slowly into a stuffy, dark room with searing spotlights overhead, in which the cloying smell of formaldehyde and sweet alcohol was even stronger. The pleasant, permeating stink was intoxicating. He smelled ether, too, and heard glass tinkling. He listened with secret egotistical mirth to the husky breathing of the two doctors. It delighted him that they thought he was unconscious and did not know he was listening. It all seemed very silly to him until one of the doctors said,
"Well, do you think we should save his life? They might be sore at us if we do."
"Let's operate," said the other doctor.
"Let's cut him open and get to the inside of things once and for all. He keeps complaining about his liver. His liver looks pretty small on his x-ray."
"That's his pancreas, you dope. This is his liver."
No, it isn't. That's his heart. I'll bet you a nickel this is his liver. I'm going to operate and find out. Should I wash my hands first?
No operations,
Yossarian said, opening his eyes and trying to sit up.
Another county heard from,
scoffed one of the doctors indignantly.
Can't we make him shut up?
We could give him a total. The ether's right here.
No totals, said Yossarian.
Another county heard from, said a doctor.
Let's give him a total and knock him out. Then we can do what we want with him.
They gave Yossarian total anesthesia and knocked him out. He woke up thirsty in a private room, drowning in ether fumes. Colonel Korn was there at his bedside, waiting calmly in a chair in his baggy wool olive-drab shirt and trousers. A bland, phlegmatic smile hung on his brown face with its heavy bearded cheeks, and he was buffing the facets of his bald head gently with the palms of both hands. He bent forward, chuckling when Yossarian awoke, and assured him in the friendliest tones that the deal they had made was still on, if Yossarian didn't die. Yossarian vomited, and Colonel Korn shot to his feet at the first cough and fled in disgust, so it seemed indeed that there was a silver lining in every cloud, Yossarian reflected, as he drifted back into a suffocating daze. A hand with sharp fingers shook him awake roughly. He turned and opened his eyes and saw a strange man with a mean face who curled his lip at him in a spiteful scowl and bragged,
"We got your pal, buddy. We got your pal."
Yossarian turned cold and faint and broke into a sweat.
"Who's my pal?"
he asked when he saw the chaplain sitting where Colonel Korn had been sitting.
"Maybe I'm your pal,"
the chaplain answered, but Yossarian couldn't hear him and closed his eyes. Someone gave him water to sip and tiptoed away. He slept and woke up feeling great until he turned his head to smile at the chaplain and saw Arfi there instead. Yossarian moaned instinctively and screwed up his face with excruciating irritability when Arfi chortled and asked how he was feeling. Arfi looked puzzled when Yossarian inquired why he was not in jail. Yossarian shut his eyes to make him go away. When he opened them, Arfi was gone, and the chaplain was there. Yossarian broke into laughter when he spied the chaplain's cheerful grin and asked him what in the hell he was so happy about.
"I'm happy about you,"
the chaplain replied with excited candor and joy. "I heard at group that you were very seriously injured and that you would have to be sent home if you lived.
Colonel Korn said your condition was critical, but I've just learned from one of the doctors that your wound is really a very slight one and that you'll probably be able to leave in a day or two. You're in no danger. It isn't bad at all."
Yossarian listened to the chaplain's news with enormous relief.
"That's good."
"Yes,"
said the chaplain, a pink flush of impish pleasure creeping into his cheeks.
"Yes, that is good."
Yossarian laughed, recalling his first conversation with the chaplain.
"You know, the first time I met you was in the hospital, and now I'm in the hospital again. It's about the only time I see you lately is in the hospital. Where have you been keeping yourself?"
The chaplain shrugged.
"I've been praying a lot," he confessed. "I try to stay in my tent as much as I can, and I pray every time Sergeant Whitcomb leaves the area so that he won't catch me."
"Does it do any good?"
"It takes my mind off my troubles," the chaplain answered with another shrug. "And it gives me something to do."
"Oh, that's good then, isn't it?"
"Yes,"
agreed the chaplain enthusiastically, as though the idea had not occurred to him before.
"Yes, I guess that is good."
He bent forward impulsively with awkward solicitude.
"Yossarian, is there anything I can do for you while you're here? Anything I can get you?"
Yossarian teased him jovially. "Like toys or candy or chewing gum?"
The chaplain blushed again, grinning self-consciously, and then turned very respectful.
"Like books, perhaps, or anything at all. I wish there was something I could do to make you happy. You know, Yossarian, we're all very proud of you."
"Proud?"
"Yes, of course.
for risking your life to stop that Nazi assassin. It was a very noble thing to do.
What Nazi assassin?
The one that came here to murder Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn. And you saved them. He might have stabbed you to death as you grappled with him on the balcony. It's a lucky thing you're alive.
Yossarian snickered sardonically when he understood.
That was no Nazi assassin.
Certainly it was. Colonel Korn said it was.
That was Natalie's girlfriend, and she was after me, not Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn. She'd been trying to kill me ever since I broke the news to her that Natalie was dead.
But how could that be?
The chaplain protested in livid and resentful confusion.
Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn both saw him as he ran away. The official report says you stopped a Nazi assassin from killing them.
Don't believe the official report, Yossarian advised dryly. It's part of the deal.
What deal?
The deal I made with Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn. They'll let me go home a big hero if I say nice things about them to everybody and never criticize them to anyone for making the rest of the men fly more missions.
The chaplain was appalled and rose halfway out of his chair. He bristled with bellicose dismay.
What? That's terrible. That's a shameful, scandalous deal, isn't it?
Odious,
Yossarian answered, staring up woodenly at the ceiling with just the back of his head resting on the pillow.
I think odious is the word we decided on.
Then how could you agree to it?
It's that or a court-martial, chaplain.
Oh,
the chaplain exclaimed with a look of stark remorse, the back of his hand covering his mouth. He lowered himself into his chair uneasily.
I shouldn't have said anything. They'd lock me in prison with a bunch of criminals. Of course. You must do whatever you think is right, then.
The chaplain nodded to himself as though deciding the argument, and lapsed into embarrassed silence.
Don't worry,
Yossarian said with a sorrowful laugh after several moments had passed.
I'm not going to do it.
But you must, the chaplain insisted, bending forward with concern. Really, you must. I had no right to influence you. I really had no right to say anything.
You didn't influence me.
Yossarian hauled himself over onto his side and shook his head in solemn mockery.
Christ, chaplain, can you imagine that for a sin? Saving Colonel Cathcart's life? That's the one crime I don't want on my record.
The chaplain returned to the subject with caution.
What will you do instead? You can't let them put you in prison.
I'll fly more missions, or maybe I really will desert and let them catch me. They probably would.
And they'd put you in prison. You don't want to go to prison.
Then I'll just keep flying missions until the war ends, I guess. Some of us have to survive.
But you might get killed.
Then I guess I won't fly any more missions.
What will you do?
I don't know.
Will you let them send you home?
I don't know. Is it hot out? It's very warm in here.
It's very cold out,
the chaplain said.
You know,
Yossarian remembered,
a very funny thing happened. Maybe I dreamed it. I think a strange man came in here before and told me he's got my pal. I wonder if I imagined it.
I don't think you did, the chaplain informed him. You started to tell me about him when I dropped in earlier.
Then he really did say it. We've got your pal, buddy, he said. We've got your pal. Had the most malignant manner I ever saw. I wonder who my pal is.
I like to think I'm your pal, Yossarian,
the chaplain said with humble sincerity.
And they certainly have got me. They've got my number. And they've got me under surveillance. And they've got me right where they want me. That's what they told me at my interrogation.
No, I don't think it's you he meant,
Yossarian decided.
I think it must be someone like Natalie or Dunbar. You know, someone who was killed in the war, like Clevenger, Orr, Dobbs, Kid Sampson, or McWatt.
Yossarian emitted a startled gasp and shook his head.
"I just realized it," he exclaimed. "They've got all my pals, haven't they? The only ones left are me and Hungry Joe."
He tingled with dread as he saw the chaplain's face go pale.
"Chaplain, what is it?"
"Hungry Joe was killed."
"God, no. On a mission?"
"He died in his sleep while having a dream. They found a cat on his face."
"Poor bastard,"
Yossarian said and began to cry, hiding his tears in the crook of his shoulder. The chaplain left without saying goodbye. Yossarian ate something and went to sleep. A hand shook him awake in the middle of the night. He opened his eyes and saw a thin, mean man in a patient's bathrobe and pajamas, who looked at him with a nasty smirk and jeered,
"We got your pal, buddy. We've got your pal."
Yossarian was unnerved.
"What the hell are you talking about?"
he pleaded in incipient panic.
"You'll find out, buddy. You'll find out."
Yossarian lunged for his tormentor's throat with one hand, but the man glided out of reach effortlessly and vanished into the corridor with a malicious laugh. Yossarian lay there trembling with a pounding pulse. He was bathed in icy sweat. He wondered who his pal was. It was dark in the hospital and perfectly quiet. He had no watch to tell him the time. He was wide awake, and he knew he was a prisoner in one of those sleepless, bedridden nights that would take an eternity to dissolve into dawn. A throbbing chill oozed up his legs. He was cold, and he thought of Snowden, who had never been his pal, but was a vaguely familiar kid who was badly wounded and freezing to death in the puddle of harsh yellow sunlight splashing into his face through the side gun port when Yossarian crawled into the rear section of the plane over the bomb bay after Dobbs had beseeched him on the intercom to help the gunner. "Please help the gunner." Yossarian's stomach turned over when his eyes first beheld the macabre scene. He was absolutely revolted, and he paused in fright a few moments before descending, crouched on his hands and knees in the narrow tunnel over the bomb bay, beside the sealed, corrugated carton containing the first aid kit. Snowden was lying on his back on the floor, with his legs stretched out, still burdened cumbersomely by his flak suit, his flak helmet, his parachute harness, and his Mae West. Not far away on the floor lay the small tail gunner in a dead faint. The wound Yossarian saw was in the outside of Snowden's thigh, as large and deep as a football, it seemed. It was impossible to tell where the shreds of his saturated coveralls ended and the ragged flesh began. There was no morphine in the first aid kit. No protection for Snowden against pain, but the numbing shock of the gaping wound itself. The 12 surettes of morphine had been stolen from their case and replaced by a cleanly lettered note that said, "What's good for M&M Enterprises is good for the country. Milo Minderbinder." Yossarian swore at Milo and held two aspirins out to ashen lips, unable to receive them. But first, he hastily drew a tourniquet around Snowden's thigh, because he could not think what else to do in those first tumultuous moments when his senses were in turmoil, when he knew he must act competently at once and feared he might go to pieces completely. Snowden watched him steadily, saying nothing. No artery was spurting, but Yossarian pretended to absorb himself entirely into the fashioning of a tourniquet, because applying a tourniquet was something he did know how to do. He worked with simulated skill and composure, feeling Snowden's lackluster gaze resting upon him. He recovered possession of himself before the tourniquet was finished and loosened it immediately to lessen the danger of gangrene. His mind was clear now, and he knew how to proceed. He rummaged through the first aid kit for scissors.
"I'm cold," Snowden said softly. "I'm cold." "You're going to be all right, kid,"
Yossarian reassured him with a grin.
"You're going to be all right." "I'm cold," Snowden said again in a frail, childlike voice. "I'm cold."
"There, there," Yossarian said, because he did not know what else to say.
There, there.
I'm cold, Snowden whimpered. I'm cold.
There, there. There, there.
Yossarian was frightened and moved more swiftly. He found a pair of scissors at last and began cutting carefully through Snowden's coveralls, high up above the wound, just below the groin. He cut through the heavy gabardine cloth all the way around the thigh in a straight line. The tiny tail gunner woke up while Yossarian was cutting with the scissors, saw him, and fainted again. Snowden rolled his head to the other side of his neck in order to stare at Yossarian more directly. A dim, sunken light glowed in his weak and listless eyes. Yossarian, puzzled, tried not to look at him. He began cutting downward through the coveralls along the inside seam. The yawning wound, was that a tube of slimy bone he saw, running deep inside the gory scarlet flow behind the twitching, startling fibers of weird muscle? Was dripping blood in several trickles, like snow melting on eaves, but viscous and red, already thickening as it dropped. Yossarian kept cutting through the coveralls to the bottom and peeled open the severed leg of the garment. It fell to the floor with a plop, exposing the hem of khaki undershorts that were soaking up blotches of blood on one side as though in thirst. Yossarian was stunned at how waxen and ghastly Snowden's bare leg looked, how loathsome, how lifeless and esoteric the downy, fine, curled blonde hairs on his odd white shin and calf. The wound, he saw now, was not nearly as large as a football, but as long and wide as his hand, and too raw and deep to see into clearly. The raw muscles inside twitched like live hamburger meat. A long sigh of relief escaped slowly through Yossarian's mouth when he saw that Snowden was not in any danger of dying. The blood was already coagulating inside the wound, and it was simply a matter of bandaging him up and keeping him calm until the plane landed. He removed some packets of sulfanilamide from the first aid kit. Snowden quivered when Yossarian pressed against him gently to turn him up slightly on his side.
"Did I hurt you?"
"I'm cold," Snowden whimpered. "I'm cold."
"There, there," Yossarian said. "There, there."
"I'm cold. I'm cold."
"There, there. There, there."
"It's starting to hurt me,"
Snowden cried out suddenly with a plaintive, urgent wince. Yossarian scrambled frantically through the first aid kit in search of morphine again and found only Milo's note and a bottle of aspirin. He cursed Milo and held two aspirin tablets out to Snowden. He had no water to offer. Snowden rejected the aspirin with an almost imperceptible shake of his head. His face was pale and pasty. Yossarian removed Snowden's flak helmet and lowered his head to the floor.
"I'm cold," Snowden moaned with half-closed eyes. "I'm cold."
The edges of his mouth were turning blue. Yossarian was petrified. He wondered whether to pull the ripcord of Snowden's parachute and cover him with the nylon folds. It was very warm in the plane. Glancing up unexpectedly, Snowden gave him a wan, cooperative smile and shifted the position of his hips a bit so that Yossarian could begin salting the wound with sulfanilamide. Yossarian worked with renewed confidence and optimism. The plane bounced hard inside an air pocket, and he remembered with a start that he had left his own parachute up front in the nose. There was nothing to be done about that. He poured envelope after envelope of the white crystalline powder into the bloody oval wound until nothing red could be seen, and then drew a deep, apprehensive breath, steeling himself with gritted teeth as he touched his bare hand to the dangling shreds of drying flesh to tuck them up inside the wound. Quickly, he covered the whole wound with a large cotton compress and jerked his hand away. He smiled nervously when his brief ordeal had ended. The actual contact with the dead flesh had not been nearly as repulsive as he had anticipated, and he found excuse to caress the wound with his fingers again and again to convince himself of his own courage. Next, he began binding the compress in place with a roll of gauze. The second time around Snowden's thigh with the bandage, he spotted a small hole on the inside, through which the piece of flak had entered, a round, crinkled wound the size of a quarter, with blue edges and a black core inside where the blood had crusted. Yossarian sprinkled this one with sulfanilamide, too, and continued unwinding the gauze around Snowden's leg until the compress was secure. Then he snipped off the roll with the scissors and slit the end down the center. He made the whole thing fast with a tidy square knot. It was a good bandage, he knew, and he sat back on his heels with pride, wiping the perspiration from his brow, and grinned at Snowden with spontaneous friendliness.
"I'm cold," Snowden moaned. "I'm cold."
"You're gonna be all right, kid,"
Yossarian assured him, patting his arm comfortingly.
"Everything's under control."
Snowden shook his head feebly.
"I'm cold,"
he repeated with eyes as dull and blind as stone.
"I'm cold."
"There, there," said Yossarian, with growing doubt and trepidation.
"There, there. A little while we'll be back on the ground, and Dr. Nika will take care of you."
But Snowden kept shaking his head and pointed at last with just the barest movement of his chin down toward his armpit. Yossarian bent forward to peer and saw a strangely colored stain seeping through the coveralls just above the armhole of Snowden's flak suit. Yossarian felt his heart stop, then pound so violently he found it difficult to breathe. Snowden was wounded inside his flak suit. Yossarian ripped open the snaps of Snowden's flak suit and heard himself scream wildly as Snowden's insides slithered down to the floor in a soggy pile and just kept dripping out. A chunk of flak more than 3 inches big had shot into his other side, just underneath the arm, and blasted all the way through, drawing whole mottled quarts of Snowden along with it, through the gigantic hole in his ribs it made as it blasted out. Yossarian screamed a second time and squeezed both hands over his eyes. His teeth were chattering in horror. He forced himself to look again. Here was God's plenty, all right, he thought bitterly as he stared. Liver, lungs, kidneys, ribs, stomach, and bits of the stewed tomatoes Snowden had eaten that day for lunch. Yossarian hated stewed tomatoes, and turned away dizzily and began to vomit, clutching his burning throat. The tail gunner woke up while Yossarian was vomiting, saw him, and fainted again. Yossarian was limp with exhaustion, pain, and despair when he finished. He turned back weakly to Snowden, whose breath had grown softer and more rapid, and whose face had grown paler. He wondered how in the world to begin to save him.
"I'm cold," Snowden whimpered. "I'm cold."
"There, there,"
Yossarian mumbled mechanically in a voice too low to be heard.
"There, there."
Yossarian was cold, too, and shivering uncontrollably. He felt goose pimples clacking all over him as he gazed down despondently at the grim secret Snowden had spilled all over the messy floor. It was easy to read the message in his entrails. Man was matter. That was Snowden's secret. Drop him out a window, and he'll fall. Set fire to him, and he'll burn. Bury him, and he'll rot like other kinds of garbage. The spirit gone, man is garbage. That was Snowden's secret. Ripeness was all.
"I'm cold,"
Snowden said.
"I'm cold."
"There, there," said Yossarian. "There, there."
He pulled the ripcord of Snowden's parachute and covered his body with the white nylon sheets.
"I'm cold."
"There, there."
Thank you.
42. Yossarian. Colonel Korn says, said Major Danby to Yossarian with a prissy, gratified smile, that the deal is still on. Everything is working out fine.
No, it isn't.
Oh, yes, indeed, Major Danby insisted benevolently. In fact, everything is much better. It was really a stroke of luck that you were almost murdered by that girl. Now the deal can go through perfectly.
I'm not making any deals with Colonel Korn.
Major Danby's effervescent optimism vanished instantly, and he broke out all at once into a bubbling sweat.
But you do have a deal with him, don't you? He asked in anguished puzzlement. Don't you have an agreement? I'm breaking the agreement.
But you shook hands on it, didn't you? You gave him your word as a gentleman.
I'm breaking my word.
Oh, dear, sighed Major Danby, and began dabbing ineffectually at his careworn brow with a folded white handkerchief.
But why, Yossarian? It's a very good deal they're offering you.
It's a lousy deal, Danby. It's an odious deal.
Oh, dear, Major Danby fretted, running his bare hand over his dark, wiry hair, which was already soaked with perspiration to the tops of the thick, close-cropped waves.
Oh, dear. Danby, don't you think it's odious?
Major Danby pondered a moment.
Yes, I suppose it is odious, he conceded with reluctance.
His globular, exophthalmic eyes were quite distraught.
But why did you make such a deal if you didn't like it?
I did it in a moment of weakness,
Yossarian wisecracked with glum irony.
I was trying to save my life.
Don't you want to save your life now?
That's why I won't let them make me fly more missions.
Then let them send you home, and you'll be in no more danger.
Let them send me home because I flew more than 50 missions, Yossarian said. And not because I was stabbed by that girl or because I've turned into such a stubborn son of a bitch.
Major Danby shook his head emphatically in sincere and bespectacled vexation.
They'd have to send nearly every man home if they did that. Most of the men have more than 50 missions. Colonel Cathcart couldn't possibly requisition so many inexperienced replacement crews at one time without causing an investigation. He's caught in his own trap.
That's his problem.
No, 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 Yossarian, Major Danby disagreed solicitously.
It's your problem. Because if you don't go through with the deal, they're going to institute court-martial proceedings as soon as you sign out of the hospital.
Yossarian thumbed his nose at Major Danby and laughed with smug elation.
The hell they will! Don't lie to me, Danby! They wouldn't even try.
But why wouldn't they?
Inquired Major Danby, blinking with astonishment.
Because I've really got them over a barrel now. There's an official report that says I was stabbed by a Nazi assassin trying to kill them. They'd certainly look silly trying to court-martial me after that.
But Yossarian, Major Danby exclaimed, there's another official report that says you were stabbed by an innocent girl in the course of extensive black market operations involving acts of sabotage and the sale of military secrets to the enemy.
Yossarian was taken back severely with surprise and disappointment.
Another official report?
Yossarian, they can prepare as many official reports as they want and choose whichever ones they need on any given occasion. Didn't you know that?
Oh, dear, Yossarian murmured in heavy dejection, the blood draining from his face.
Oh, dear.
Major Danby pressed forward avidly with a look of vulturous well-meaning.
Yossarian, do what they want and let them send you home. It's best for everyone that way.
It's best for Cathcart, Korn, and me. Not for everyone.
For everyone, Major Danby insisted. It will solve the whole problem.
Is it best for the men in the group who will have to keep flying more missions?
Major Danby flinched and turned his face away uncomfortably for a second.
Yossarian, he replied, it will help nobody if you force Colonel Cathcart to court-martial you and prove you guilty of all the crimes with which you'll be charged. You'll go to prison for a long time, and your whole life will be ruined.
Yossarian listened to him with a growing feeling of concern.
What crimes will they charge me with?
Incompetence over Ferrara? Insubordination?
Refusal to engage the enemy in combat when ordered to do so? And desertion?
Yossarian sucked his cheeks in soberly.
They could charge me with all that, couldn't they? They gave me a medal for Ferrara. How could they charge me with incompetence now?
Arfi will swear that you and McWatt lied in your official report.
I'll bet the bastard would.
They will also find you guilty, Major Danby recited, of rape, extensive black market operations, acts of sabotage, and the sale of military secrets to the enemy.
How will they prove any of that? I never did a single one of those things.
But they have witnesses who will swear you did. They can get all the witnesses they need simply by persuading them that destroying you is for the good of the country. And in a way, it would be for the good of the country.
In what way?
Yossarian demanded, rising up slowly on one elbow with bridling hostility. Major Danby drew back a bit and began mopping his forehead again.
Well, Yossarian, he began with an apologetic stammer,
it would not help the war effort to bring Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn into disrepute now.
Let's face it, Yossarian, in spite of everything, the group does have a very good record. If you were court-martialed and found innocent, other men would probably refuse to fly missions, too. Colonel Cathcart would be in disgrace, and the military efficiency of the unit might be destroyed. So in that way, it would be for the good of the country to have you found guilty and put in prison, even though you are innocent.
What a sweet way you have of putting things, Yossarian snapped with caustic resentment. Major Danby turned red and squirmed and squinted uneasily.
Please, don't blame me, he pleaded with a look of anxious integrity. You know, it's not my fault. All I'm doing is trying to look at things objectively and arrive at a solution to a very difficult situation.
I didn't create the situation.
But you can resolve it. And what else can you do?
You don't want to fly more missions.
I can run away.
Run away?
Desert! Take off! I can turn my back on the whole damn mess and start running!
Major Danby was shocked.
Where to? Where could you go?
I could get to Rome easily enough, and I could hide myself there.
And live in danger every minute of your life that they would find you?
No,
Yossarian.
That would be a disastrous and ignoble thing to do. Running away from problems never solved them.
Please believe me. I am only trying to help you.
That's what that kind detective said before he decided to jab his thumb into my wound.
Yossarian retorted sarcastically.
I am not a detective,
Major Danby replied with indignation, his cheeks flushing again. I am a university professor with a highly developed sense of right and wrong, and I wouldn't try to deceive you.
I wouldn't lie to anyone.
What would you do if one of the men in the group asked you about this conversation?
I would lie to him.
Yossarian laughed mockingly, and Major Danby, despite his blushing discomfort, leaned back with relief as though welcoming the respite Yossarian's changing mood promised. Yossarian gazed at him with a mixture of reserved pity and contempt. He sat up in bed with his back resting against the headboard, lit a cigarette, smiled slightly with wry amusement, and stared with whimsical sympathy at the vivid pop-eyed horror that had implanted itself permanently on Major Danby's face the day of the mission to Avignon when General Dreidel had ordered him taken outside and shot. The startled wrinkles would always remain, like deep black scars, and Yossarian felt sorry for the gentle, moral, middle-aged idealist, as he felt sorry for so many people, whose shortcomings were not large, and whose troubles were light. With deliberate amiability, he said,
Danby, how can you work along with people like Cathcart and Korn? Doesn't it turn your stomach?
Major Danby seemed surprised by Yossarian's question.
I do it to help my country, he replied, as though the answer should have been obvious.
Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn are my superiors,
and obeying their orders is the only contribution I can make to the war effort. I work along with them because it's my duty. And also, he added in a much lower voice, dropping his eyes, because I am not a very aggressive person.
Your country doesn't need your help anymore, Yossarian reasoned without antagonism. So all you're doing is helping them.
I try not to think of that, Major Danby admitted frankly. I try to concentrate on only the big result, and to forget that they are succeeding, too. I try to pretend that they are not significant.
That's my trouble, you know,
Yossarian mused sympathetically, folding his arms.
Between me and every ideal, I always find Shishkovs, Peckhams, Korns, and Cathcarts. And that sort of changes the ideal.
You must try not to think of them, Major Danby advised affirmatively. And you must never let them change your values. Ideals are good, but people are sometimes not so good. You must try to look up at the big picture. Yossarian rejected the advice with a skeptical shake of his head.
When I look up, I see people cashing in. I don't see heaven or saints or angels. I see people cashing in on every decent impulse and every human tragedy.
But you must try not to think of that, Major Danby insisted. And you must try not to let it upset you.
Oh, it doesn't really upset me. What does upset me, though, is that they think I'm a sucker. They think that they're smart and that the rest of us are dumb. And you know, Danby, the thought occurs to me right now for the first time that maybe they're right.
But you must try not to think of that, too, argued Major Danby. You must think only of the welfare of your country and the dignity of man.
Yeah, said Yossarian.
I mean it, Yossarian. This is not World War I. You must never forget that we're at war with aggressors who would not let either one of us live if they won.
I know that,
Yossarian replied tersely with a sudden surge of scowling annoyance.
Christ, Danby, I earned that medal I got, no matter what their reasons were for giving it to me. I've flown 70 goddamn combat missions. Don't talk to me about fighting to save my country. I've been fighting all along to save my country. Now I'm going to fight a little to save myself. The country's not in danger anymore, but I am.
The war's not over yet. The Germans are driving toward Antwerp.
The Germans will be beaten in a few months, and Japan will be beaten a few months after that. If I were to give up my life now, it wouldn't be for my country. It would be for Cathcart and Korn. So I'm turning in my bombsight for the duration. From now on, I'm thinking only of me.
Major Danby replied indulgently with a superior smile. But Yossarian, suppose everyone felt that way.
Then I'd certainly be a damned fool to feel any other way, wouldn't I?
Yossarian sat up straighter with a quizzical expression.
You know, I have a queer feeling that I've been through this exact conversation before with someone. It's just like the chaplain sensation of having experienced everything twice.
The chaplain wants you to let them send you home, Major Danby remarked.
The chaplain can jump in the lake.
Oh, dear, Major Danby sighed, shaking his head in regretful disappointment. He's afraid he might have influenced you.
He didn't influence me. You know what I might do? I might stay right here in this hospital bed and vegetate. I could vegetate very comfortably right here and let other people make the decisions.
You must make decisions, Major Danby disagreed. A person can't live like a vegetable.
Why not?
A distant, warm look entered Major Danby's eyes. It must be nice to live like a vegetable, he conceded wistfully.
It's lousy,
answered Yossarian.
No, it must be very pleasant to be free from all this doubt and pressure, insisted Major Danby.
I'd like to live like a vegetable and make no important decisions.
What kind of vegetable, Danby?
Cucumber or a carrot?
What kind of cucumber, a good one or a bad one? Oh, a good one, of course. They'd cut you off in your prime and slice you up for salad.
Major Danby's face fell.
A poor one, then.